Welcome to the Performance Recipe Podcast with me, Richard Stewart, a performance nutritionist and personal trainer. We all know we can get tangled amongst the facts and fads on social media, and so the purpose of this podcast is to bridge the gap between science and practice by having industry experts on all topics performance related. I became a performance nutritionist because of my background in Michelin star restaurants and being a personal trainer, bridging the gap between food and fitness. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome to episode 3 of the Performance Recipe Podcast. Next up, we have Charlotte, the owner of Flourish Wellness Coaching, with expertise and qualifications in all things eating disorders and disordered eating. Hi, Charlotte. Thank you so much for joining me on my podcast. I hope you're well. I just want to start off with saying thank you for coming on. And you can introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about your experiences, qualifications, etc. That'd be very much appreciated.
Amazing. Well, thank you for having me. I'm grateful for the opportunity. My name is Charlotte. I founded Flourish Wellness Coaching, which is essentially a coaching platform, but I also teach Pilates. I host wellness events. This year, I'm kind of branching out into like the retreat event area as well. But kind of how it all started for me was I trained as a dancer from a very young age. I always wanted to be a professional dancer. I went on to university and studied dance performance at a high level. And wanted to be like a classical contemporary dancer. But unfortunately, throughout my, I guess, childhood, but also like later teenage years, and as I went down, when I went to university, I moved down to London, I developed an eating disorder. I developed a whole heap of body image issues, and then like a really negative relationship with exercise, food, myself. And that also had a really, really negative impact on my dancing. And ultimately, it got to the point where I had to just kind of like take myself out of the dance industry, because I just wasn't, in hindsight now looking back, like mentally resilient to deal with everything. I needed to heal. I think my study in terms of like eating disorders started when I actually was at university. So I chose the dance science route for my dissertation, and I decided to explore how negative or neurotic perfectionism influences the onset of disordered eating in female first year contemporary dancers. It had to be literally so specific. And the research just took me down this whole rabbit hole of the self, the person, the personality traits, how all of these things influence our relationship with food, and then how that affects our dance, our dancing, why we decide to do and choose the path that we choose. And yeah, it kind of just went on from there, and I was like, oh, actually, crap, from all this like study that I'm doing, and I had to actually do like the so I had to like run like case studies myself and actually interview the first years, I realized I'm not the only one struggling in this way. It's really, 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 really common within dancers. I learned a lot about myself, a lot about the industry. And I was like, okay, well, I want to go into the fitness industry to, I knew from stepping into the fitness industry, I wanted to do it to make a change. I didn't want to go in just to personal train people. I was like, I want to go in to make a change and almost disrupt the fitness industry. I had to start from the bottom. So I did do my personal training qualification. I then went on to study more about sports and exercise nutrition. And then last year, I finished my first part of training with the National Centre for Eating Disorders. So that's where it's kind of taken me now.
Perfect. So you've kind of, you've literally been in the trenches. You've literally experienced it yourself. And then you grew from that. And I think when it comes to disordered eating, eating disorders, there's definitely not enough coaches like you around. There's a lot who claim to be like you. And I don't think a lot of them realize how much harm they could potentially be giving. This is why I wanted to speak to you and just create this awareness, because I think most of the time it does come from a good place. And I'd like to believe that anybody in the fitness industry starts off by at least wanting to help others, as opposed to just like an easy career choice, how some people do go into PT, for example, but then they don't usually last very long because they realize getting clients is one thing and then getting results is another thing. Mm-hmm. So again, thank you, because like I have come across obviously those who work in nutritional sciences. You've got obviously psychologists and psychiatrists that potentially be working in these type of fields, but someone who's specifically around coaching with wellness and disorder eating, eating disorders, you're the only person I know, which tells you how few there actually are. You obviously see in social media about others who have been through it themselves, but haven't gone and taken the step up to actually go and study it themselves. A lot of people think that they have a passion about something, but don't actually put it into action by going and actually trying to understand the different levels that each individual has to go through, and understanding different personality types as well, I suppose, is a factor.
Yeah, it blew my mind, definitely, with the study that I've recently just done. The first weekend of that study, it was like 3 days, like 8 hours, just on the first weekend of it. And I came off and I was like, my brain was just fried, but because there's so much to it. And even I knew this is the route that I wanted to go down, but when I did first step into the industry, I was very strict with my boundaries, and I made mistakes as a coach when I first got into the industry, as I think every coach does, is because you take influences of who you learn from at the time. But the one thing I will always stand my ground on is I never pushed anyone to do anything that they wasn't comfortable to do. So if I had people come to me and, you know, they say they really wanted fat loss, weight loss, or to change their body, but I could tell they were probably really struggling, I wouldn't diagnose them, but I also wouldn't give them a restrictive diet or a meal plan or anything like that. I always tried to work in a very holistic route. And I think at that point early on in my career, it was down to just giving the client guidance, but letting them come to terms. And then I had clients turn around to me like a year later, go, I think I really do struggle with food. And I'm like, I know, but I didn't necessarily have the qualifications. I mean, I still can't diagnose now, but I didn't have the relevant qualifications and study back then to be like, this is what I would probably say to you, even though I know it, just because it's a lot of the stuff that I saw in myself.
Yeah. Okay. So I just want to dive into what exactly we're talking about a bit more. So is there any way you can define the differences between an eating disorder and then disordered eating?
Yeah, I think this is a really great question. I think especially on social media, it gets very blurry with the lines. So eating disorders, by definition, are extreme weight and shape control behaviors, which when you look at the fitness industry, a lot of that is encouraged, extreme weight and shape, especially when it steps into like the bodybuilding, bikini competing world. It's very extreme, but that is, in a nutshell, an eating disorder is extreme weight and shape control behavior. But it's also classified by something called the DSM-5, which is a diagnostic statistic manual of mental disorders. So each eating disorder, for example, anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder, you've got non-classified feeding and eating disorders. You've got orthorexia, you've got anorexic bulimics, they will all fall into the DSM-5. And it's a certain criteria that the patient has to hit to be classified with an eating disorder. Disordered eating is, it's like a really broad umbrella term that is just used to describe like a really huge range of irregular eating patterns. And these irregular eating patterns might cross over with a lot of the criteria from the DSM-5, but it basically means that a patient might not hit. So, for anorexia, you've got all of this criteria the patient needs to hit. Maybe they touch on some of them, but they don't hit all of them. So they can't be classified as anorexic, but they maybe might be very restrictive. They might have really rigid beliefs around food that they can't eat past 6 o'clock at night, or carbs are going to make them fat, or fat will make them fat, or really distorted body image. You know, you can have binge eating where you maybe binge eat once a week or once a month, but binge eating disorder is classified if you binge on average 2 to 3 times a week for, I think it's like 3 months consistently, then it's classified as a disorder. So that's the difference with those two.
Okay, and then with social media and how there's a lot of claims, a lot of anecdotal information going out there, a lot of misinformation out there. I'm not sure how long you've been in this area for, but I'm assuming you probably network with other people that work in similar sort of environment. And I'm just wondering, with the age of social media especially, how much of that has actually increased? How much of that has actually gotten worse by listening to people giving out this misinformation?
Oh, it's wild, and it's not like even like not from a work perspective, but from a personal perspective. So when I was really, really, really struggling, and I lived down in London, I would follow a lot of like almost influencers and fitness influencers online who were sharing their workouts and what they eat in a day and all these. And like, I was 19, 20 years old when I lived in London. So I was very subject to this stuff and trying to hold and achieve an ideal dancer's body. I was following these influencers who were then some of the worst entering bikini competitions. And it's crazy now because I still follow a lot of them, but a lot of their rhetorics have changed because they were also struggling with eating disorders themselves, but they either they weren't aware of it. They were aware, but they had so much of their identity tied to it that it was hard when that was almost like their business. So just my experience of like taking that information on, I'm now looking at these people, and a lot of them also don't take responsibility. There's only a handful of them that take responsibility of, you know, I profited and monetized off this. Now I'm telling you a completely different story. And you have the whole argument narrative of what's like body positivity. So you've got that, which is at the complete opposite end. And with social media, there is constant extremes. Like there's the crew over here promoting still like bodybuilding and X, Y, Z or restrictive diet. There's people over here promoting self love and body positivity, but to the point of not exercising and rebelling. But I'm also, you know, I think the answer always lies somewhere in the middle. And I think you have to, as an individual, and this is something that I did myself, but I also encourage my clients to do, you've got to get really, really selective with what information is relevant to you, but really learning how to source out like a good source of information and a bad source of information, and almost cultivate your feed that is something that's going to make you feel good. And like, you know, if you're opening your Instagram feed and you're looking and it's just people that maybe you can't relate to, or it's unachievable bodies or X, Y, and Z, but people that you just open up through no fault of their own as well, it works both ways. But if that makes you feel really crap about yourself, it's maybe time to unfollow them or take yourself away from social media. It can be such an educational tool, but it can also be such a damaging tool.
Absolutely. Well said. Like, people tend to forget that it's all down to context and relevance, which we've spoken about before. And it's so important. But you're also saying that you have come across clients who wanted to drop fat, or whatever it might be, changing up the body composition once upon a time. And then you've also realized, because they come to you at some point saying, actually, do you know what? I do have an eating disorder or disordered eating. You go, yeah, I know. Like, let me help you there. So can you define to me what are the symptoms and behaviors of disordered eating or eating disorders?
Just a quick break. If you find this information useful, please like, subscribe, and send this to a friend. Otherwise, let's get back to the conversation.
There's many, we call them like predisposing factors. And so, well, predisposing factors are almost like the causes and the things that kind of feed into an eating disorder and the kind of maintenance of an eating disorder. But kind of typical symptoms could be distorted body image, using your body shape or your weight as your primary measure of your self-worth. So that's a huge one, is people will step on the scale or attach to a number, maybe a dress size or 60 kilograms, 58 kilograms, like whatever number that is on the scale, and that is their entire self-worth, and wrap that up. Super strict rules around like eating and exercise. So maybe you are so literally rigid with your exercise routine that if you miss a session, all hell breaks loose, or, you know, if you can't eat what you plan to eat, everything out, the world is crumbling down around you. Restricting foods or eliminating food groups entirely. Very kind of severe fluctuations of weight. So maybe like really rapidly gaining weight and then losing weight really quickly. trying different diets. In the fitness industry, the abuse of steroids and different kind of performance enhancing drugs. Binge eating, so emotional eating, comfort eating, a restricted social life. There's so many different kind of factors. The one that I think I typically see with people is the binge eating, comfort eating, emotional eating, especially for the disordered eating category. Those that maybe don't necessarily have an eating disorder, but disordered eating, or things like fasting, purging, vomiting, abusing laxatives. like unhealthy weight control behaviors. So there was many, many more, but like off the top of my head, they're like kind of.
there's so many different areas, 100%. And yeah. I think I tend to forget that weight on a scale is just, I heard, I've got her name now, Dr. Keely something. She said, and she put it really well, the weight on a scale is a unit of measurement with measuring essentially gravity at any specific moment in time.
Yeah.
It's nothing to do with your fat, like, except obviously a little bit to do with your fat, but it's your bone mineral density, it's how much fiber sitting in your gut can last up to 3 days, glycogen, stored carbohydrates, the content that you've had, you drink, before you stand on a scale, drink a liter, well, weigh yourself, drink a liter of water, stand on the scale, you'll increase by 1 kg. It's not fat mass. The thing is, I had a client who did the body composition analysis, lost 5 kgs over 3 months. But when we do the body composition, he gained 0.6 kgs of muscle, and he gained 0.8 kgs of bone mineral density. Now, those are two numbers that the scale is not going to tell you about. That's an increase of 2, but the overall weight is dropped down by 5. So what is that? Probably around 7-ish kgs of fat mass that's probably been lost. And some water.
And I think this education is so important, is because I teach my clients about this all the time, but sometimes really trying to, I get a lot of clients who, the ones who are really struggling, understand that. They understand it on paper and they get it, but they still sometimes can't pull themselves away. And that is then when it gets to a deeper point of, you are tying all of your worth again into a number like that. Now we need to work on your self-worth, your self-esteem away from that. Like you can understand that on like a like really like educational level, but sometimes people still struggle to really, really, really let go of that number and then develop that trust. And it's hard genuinely trying to get some clients to completely pull away from the scale. And it almost has to be done in like small doses, because it's the anxiety and the way I approach it with clients is almost getting them to become aware of the habits and actions that they engage in after when they've weighed themselves. So if they step on the scale and they are like a 0.5 kilogram lighter, sometimes they might think, oh, I'm not going to eat now because it's working. I'm like, no, because that behavior then in itself is not healthy. It's keeping you stuck. And then, you know, then there's more education required around, well, why is it bad for the body if we skip meals, if we start fasting, especially as females with our hormones? There's all of these things and all the science that backs up, you know, we need to be eating regularly. So it's such a fine dance with every single client on how you approach these things.
Yeah. Like, so with females, they need about 18 milligrams of iron a day. Males need about 8. They need more than double the amount of iron that men need. But now we're telling people, and then there's calcium as well, which is another nutrient, which women, especially later in life, when estrogen starts to drop down, and bone metabolism starts to decrease, chances of osteoporosis increases. And then we're now telling people, eat less calories. What comes with less calories? Less nutrients. Less nutrients.
Exactly.
Four of issues.
And that's really interesting, because I tell this story to my clients all the time, but I did food technology as a GCSE, right? Basic GCSE, but I learned how to cook pastas and curries and cheesecakes and everything. But within food technology as a GCSE, the thing that I remember the most was like my food technology teacher teaching us that fat within food, like good healthy fats, also give food flavor. So cooking with like butters and oils and things, and it gives your food flavor. In pastries, it gives the food flavor, the pastry flavor. And then as I got older and I slipped into my eating disorder, fat was what I took away. So I started cooking my eggs in fry light. I started cooking using coconut oil when Joe Wicks told everybody that coconut oil was fantastic, but I stopped using butter, I stopped using good quality olive oil, all these things that are all healthy fats. And I look back and I'm like, my eggs were so bland, my food was so bland and tasteless, and nothing, like food didn't give me that satisfaction. But then also from a health nutrients perspective, healthy fats for females are essential in so many ways. But diet culture and a lot of, personal trainers that I had back in the day were like, oh yeah, just use fry light. And I was like, yeah, okay, cool. I'm cutting loads of calories that way.
Yeah. One calorie spray. That's it.
Yeah. And like, sadly, that was like things that when I first stepped into the industry, I would, and I'd hold my hands up if clients said to me, like, you know, what should I use for eyelash? And I would endorse the use of eyelash. I wouldn't necessarily say don't use oil, like use butter you can, but this is a great alternative for less calories. And I look back now and I'm like, that was so stupid, but that's what the fitness industry had taught me.
It's mind-blowing because they didn't realize, like the amount of times I hear, it's always PTs, and like, I just like to remind people that with a PT qualification, it's a 3-month qualification. And you've got people who have studied nutritional qualifications that are a year, 2 years, 3 years. Some of these guys, PhDs and postdocs doing it for sometimes 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
And think about where you're getting your information from, because fats are so important. PTs will very often just go low calories, less fat. And it's like, there's a minimum requirement to help with your body in terms of hormone production, immune function, brain health, and so much more. So yeah, like focusing on nutrients and not just calories, very important. So something else I wanted to talk to you about is, obviously there is an impact with disordered eating disorders on from an individual level, but what kind of effect does that have on people's friends and family, and can that have a social impact too?
Yeah, definitely. 100%. It can cause people to become very distant from friends and family, to like skip out on social events, to also, like, the only way I can describe it from my experience was I almost had like a whole personality shift. Like, there would be the anxiety I felt around social events that involved food, or I remember sometimes coming home, and I lived with my parents back when I really was at my worst. And, you know, on the way home after having a really busy day at work, asking, like, ringing my mum, being like, oh, can you take something out the freezer for me? Because I want this for food. And she'd be like, oh, well, we don't have it in. And me just like almost losing my shit, being like, no, we've got to have this in, because I have to have this for dinner today, because I was so, it was that. And if I didn't have that, I knew it was the control. If I didn't have that, it was like, well, I can't have anything else because I won't know the calories, I won't know the protein content. Then if I do have something else, it's not going to be what it should have been. It's thrown everything off. I can't go over the calories, and then I'll probably lead to a binge. It was just, it's this whole rolling of like kind of scenarios. But when you're in it, you can't see any different. So it definitely hindered like my relationships, not necessarily for me personally, not necessarily my relationships with my closest friends, because I was very, very fortunate that I had like best friends that I could lean on and open up to. But saying that, I had this conversation with like two of my closest friends. We worked together when we were 19, and we all had an eating disorder, and we were incredibly toxic, but we didn't realize it to each other. So we would get ready for nights out, and we were tiny humans. We had 19-year-old bodies anyway. The bodies were still growing, but we were tiny humans. We'd get ready for nights out, and I'd be like, well, I feel fat. No, you look great. I look fat. And, you know, and then we would not eat before we went on a night out to save calories for alcohol. And we would all be engaging in this behavior, and like, we wouldn't be encouraging each other, but because we were all so damaged, we look back and it's like, oh my god, that was not a good environment to be in. And you'd look at one of your friends and you'd be like, oh my god, she's so small, maybe I need to eat less because I think she looks amazing, so I need to be smaller than her. And then they would probably be thinking the same. And so I think even sometimes if you don't realize it, especially female friendships, they can be some of the most toxic environments, even if you have the best intentions for each other, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. I've heard that so many times from clients who I've had to. So I have a select few links to different psychologists that I just refer my clients to, and then I work in collaboration with some of these people. Because when someone comes to me and I recognize that I think there's potential for disordered eating disorders, I get them on call with one of these people. And I just realize, because I know people that are quite close to me have similar sort of scenarios in the past, like back home in South Africa. And I just have seen what it can do to people. And it's not fun, physically and mentally. So I'm just looking down because I've got a few questions which I want to make sure I definitely ask you, because I feel are quite relevant. And you're talking about, obviously, going out on nights out. And obviously, I've come across it where people are a bit afraid of what they're going to eat later in the day. So sometimes they just don't eat at all during the day because they'll need to save the calories for later, not realizing that they have a metabolism which requires energy, and you have a whole body, which is your brain thinking, eyes moving, whatever. You burn off a lot of calories just existing, never mind the extra energy expenditure you have. So I just wanted to ask, how do you manage coming out of that kind of situation? How do you break away from that and that sort of mindset? And how do you manage it when you're out and about for daily life or seeing friends, seeing family? And where would you go for seeking advice and help?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I think it's not black and white. And like, you know, my simple answer would be it depends, which is not helpful. But it, again, context and relevance, like depending on how much the person is struggling. I would always kind of like the specific advice I would give to someone. The advice that I would have wanted when I was younger, first of all, is someone to say to me that I'm not broken. I'm not a problem. Like, it's not me. I am not the issue. My body is not the issue. And that is not what needs changing. I am a result of a multitude of beliefs, belief systems that I've developed from being a child, experiences, things that I've seen, things that have happened to me that has caused this awful relationship with my body and food. And the first thing I would say is trying to find some sort of support network. So either whether that be a parent, a friend, like a family member, someone at your local gym, like anyone who that is that safe space to go to and say, look, I am struggling. Like I need help with this. And that's one of the hardest parts. I remember the first time I opened up, it was to my two best friends in the world. And I was just about to go back to university after my first Christmas break. And I was like, I'm not okay. Like, I'm struggling. I think I've got a problem with food. And their first answer was, we know, like, we can tell. And it was heartbreaking, but I almost felt like a weight had been lifted that I'd shared this. And then I went to the NHS and to the doctors and was like, I think I need a referral. And I went through that route. But the crap thing about that route is it's such a long wait list. It's incredibly painfully long, and a lot of people fall through the net. There are some really incredible spaces and charities and things that are set up. So BEAT, which is really great, and First Steps ED, UK based, which are really like good, fantastic charities that have a lot of information and help and support groups, but access to really good therapists as well. The sad part is if you are on an NHS waitlist that can be really long, but then you can't afford private therapy, a lot of these people fall through the net. And that's where it gets murky and it gets tricky. But the one thing that I say absolutely saved me, and I didn't understand necessarily why until I started doing my training, but yoga helped me so much. Yoga is a form of exercise that it's not about what you look like. It's not about aesthetics, even if you see some really super bendy people on Instagram. But the kind of like the essence of what yoga is, like yoga it's almost like a lifestyle. Like the principles of yoga you can take away from the mat and you can implement in your daily life. But yoga actually helps you to slow down, connect with your body, connect with your breath, create these connections that are lost when we have an eating disorder or when we have body image issues, because we essentially, people who suffer with an eating disorder or disordered eating are simultaneously like super connected to their body because they're hyper aware of their body. They're hype almost to the point where they're like, they can feel every part. Like I remember thinking, oh, I can pinch my skin or I can feel my fat rolls. I didn't have any. I was tiny. Like, but also we're very disconnected in terms of our brain to like mind to body connection and like calling our body our home. So for me, yoga was like the biggest thing. But then finding that kind of like support group or your support group, and there's no right and wrong. Some people really do require the work of a psychiatrist or a therapist. Some people, depending where how far down the scale you are, some people need hospitalization and some people need a whole team and like an inpatient kind of setting. Some people can literally help themselves by doing things like yoga and finding support groups and things. So it there's a whole spectrum. I hope that answers that.
100%. Like, I just, so much advice there, because exercise is not just good for obviously from a physical perspective, but from the mind as well. And I think people tend to neglect that fact, and just getting into healthier habits as just starting off with one thing, like going to one class. And you might meet other people that have been through similar situations, and then from those habits you can build up on more. So I don't have much time left. I'm trying to keep the podcast to a 30 minute performance recipe. So I just want to ask one quick question, and then if you could tell me a bit more about where we can find you and your coaching. So first, what do you think we can be done in the future to help people with disordered eating or disordered eating orders? And what is your goal as a coach?
Amazing. I love this question. There's many things that can be done. I think if we focus specifically on the fitness industry, I think there needs to be a lot more of awareness of the damage that a lot of the information in the fitness industry can cause. It's a very big process. I think it starts with us. I think if coaches as individuals can learn a little bit more, we don't all have to become experts in eating disorders or disordered eating, but we can learn more about, okay, you know, yeah, tracking calories is pushed down everyone's throat, but maybe it isn't the answer for everybody. It's not to say that it doesn't work for some people or it's not a tool for some people, but it doesn't work for everybody. And it should be used in very contextual situations. So I think there needs to be more of awareness. There also needs to be more transparency in what it actually takes for people who are in like the bodybuilding industry, the bikini competing industry, of these are dangerous behaviours. If you're not mentally resilient enough for it, and if you don't have a good relationship with food, this is a very dangerous place to be in. It's not for everybody. And there needs to be more kind of ruthlessness from coaches who do compete, who do coach those kind of athletes, to be like, you shouldn't step on stage if they know someone is struggling, just to get the transformation photo. So there needs to be more accountability and awareness with the fitness industry, for one. There needs to be more support in general. So I think my goal as a coach is, and I always say this to people who inquire about coaching or my clients, I straight up say, I'm not a dietitian and I'm not a psychologist. I am not here for those roles. I know where I have studied, I know what my limitations are, and I try to provide a very ethical practice. So I will work with you in the capacity that I can work with you. And if I feel like it needs more help, that is when I refer out. But I think my goal as a coach is for those people that do slip through the net. So the people who probably do have disordered eating, they're not deep into that eating disorder realm, but they don't necessarily qualify on the NHS for a referral, because again, you've got to meet a certain criteria when you go to the NHS to your GP to get a referral. If you don't meet that criteria, you won't get referred to the eating disorder services. But then they might not be able to afford like private therapy with a psychologist or eating disorder counsellor, because they actually can be quite expensive. So the people who I know that I definitely can help, who may really have disordered eating and really distorted view around the food in their body, that's where I kind of come in to help these people who, if they slipped through the net, they probably would develop an eating disorder. But I want to be that middleman and then eventually create like a community, like of people that where they feel like they've got somewhere to go for support, or eventually get into helping educate coaches so we can make changes in the fitness industry. So there's a lot to be done, but
Amazing. Thank you for all of that. I just want to say thank you for your time as well. Unfortunately, I could talk about this forever, but if you just want to say a little bit about your socials, where we can find you, and yeah, we'll finish off with that.
Yeah. So mostly Instagram, it's flourishcoaching_. And then there's like a link in my bio to like websites and how you can inquire to work about me and loads of information on events and stuff. So yeah, thank you.
Amazing. Thank you so much. We need more coaches like you.
Thank you for having me.
Right. Take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you found it useful, please share with a friend. They would also benefit from these talks. If you'd like to keep up with everything else I get up to, you can check out my Instagram at rich_performance_nutritionist, and feel free to drop me a message with your thoughts and feedback on this weekly chat so far.